what we're trying to do is maximize the resource development of Alaska and our country's resources.
The state gears up for an aggressive lease sale to attract new oil investment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 30th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the courts rule with the federal government on polar bear protections.
It is a very strong affirmation of the science.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Governor Parnell announced today plans to aggressively push oil development on state lands and waters, including areas next to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. In October, the state will offer lease sales on 14.7 million acres in the Beaufort Sea and on the North Slope and North Slope foothills. Parnell made his announcement by video conference to reporters gathered at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington, D.C.
Lease sales on state lands and the exploration and development on state lands has a greater opportunity of success today than any of the federal lease sales, which really haven't even moved forward at this point. So we as a state are going to do everything we can to promote domestic American energy production.
Parnell claims the state can move faster than the federal government, and he wants to see leases in areas like the Beaufort Sea's waters right next to the controversial and off-limits coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. The state's Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan was in D.C. in person and responded to a reporter's question of whether the state's move is a shot across the bow intended to rile up the federal government.
The answer to that is no. What we're trying to do is maximize the resource development of Alaska and our country's resources. And we're, as the governor mentioned, we have a very comprehensive strategy in doing that.
Sullivan says oil companies which drill in state areas could likely reach oil lying beneath ANWR or NPRA. He says the state reads that to be legal because of the law of capture.
So you're on state land, you drill straight down, and then, as you know, large oil and gas fields don't necessarily respect state and federal boundaries. And if there was something that straddled state and federal boundaries, the company or entity drilling that well would have the right, legal right, to drain it on both sides of the boundary.
Sullivan says directional or sideways drilling into non-state areas would not be allowed. The three-mile zone next to the Arctic Refuge has been leased before, but none are active and there's been little development. Officials said today that back in the 1990s, Conoco drilled a commercial well but didn't use it to produce. Sullivan and the governor say they're optimistic oil companies will be interested in fresh state leases, but it remains to be seen. ConocoPhillips Alaska spokeswoman Natalie Lohman says the company doesn't generally comment on lease sales, but she would say this.
Well, ConocoPhillips will look at this opportunity just as we would any other exploration area around the world, and it will have to compete with other regions for our exploration dollars.
State officials say they'll keep parts of the Beaufort Sea off limits to protect the bowhead whale's migration and calving grounds. Harold Curran with the North Slope Borough says he appreciates that. He says in general, the borough favors onshore drilling over offshore, but he says offshore drilling in state waters is better than offshore drilling in federal waters because it increases the borough's tax base and is better for the environment.
Places that we have supported in terms of offshore development are shallow. They're done generally from gravel islands, and there are generally done inside barrier islands. So the impacts from noise and other industrial impacts to especially bowhead whales, but other marine mammals are mitigated as a result of that.
But environmental groups say there's no proven technology to clean up an oil spill in icy waters. The Arctic Program Director with the Wilderness Society, Lois Epstein, says there are still too many unknowns about drilling in the Arctic waters, whether it's a state, territory, or not.
There are going to be enormous problems with offshore drilling. We saw what happened last summer with the BP Gulf tragedy. This is not a well-regulated, well-overseen industry, and what we have is a very sensitive Arctic Ocean ecosystem and coastline, and the coastline is where the Arctic refuge could be affected.
Governor Parnell and DNR Commissioner Sullivan say pushing the lease sales is part of Parnell's strategy to get more oil into the Trans-Alaska pipeline. The death of two Yakutat residents last week brings to seven the number of commercial fishermen killed this year in Alaska, and the season is just getting started. The fact that all seven lost their lives in open boats and all were wearing life jackets has caught the attention of agencies involved in marine safety. There is consensus that it's time for renewed focus on safety training for the small boat fleet. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It is Jerry Dugan's responsibility to go out of his way to interview survivors following commercial fishing accidents. The recent loss of Wayne Gray and Rex Newland on the dangerous river near Yakutat is no exception. But learning the details of this story was particularly hard.
Two of the people in this incident recently in Yakutat had taken training from us just in February, a drill conductor course.
Dugan heads the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association in Sitka, or AMSEA. Dugan says the accident immediately makes him think about what in the training might have helped in this situation and what he might have emphasized more. Dugan interviewed the lone survivor, 30-year-old Jonathan Pavlik, at Sitka's Mount Edgecombe Hospital. Pavlik was rescued after an aircraft pilot spotted him clinging to the top of the overturned skiff. Dugan says Pavlik was quite open about what elements of the AMSEA training had stuck with him.
Don't go in the water. Stay out of the water. That's a really important point.
Cold water survival training is an overriding theme of AMSEA's courses. The program trains fishermen on vessels from one-person operations to factory processors. Cold water is the one thing that all Alaskan fisheries have in common. AMSEA also stresses the importance of personal flotation devices, but Pavlik was not wearing one. The two men who died were wearing life jackets, as were the five clam diggers who lost their lives in Cook Inlet in May.
The message isn't that PFDs don't save your life.
Jennifer Lincoln is with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health in Anchorage.
The message is that PFDs do save your life, but you also have to make sure that somebody knows that you're in trouble.
Lincoln and NIOSH have done extensive work on open boat safety over the past few years. But the Cook Inlet and Yakutat tragedies comprise a cluster of sorts. She says she's been expecting increased media attention on these events and the fact that PFDs did not save lives. Lincoln says personal flotation is just the first step in survival in Alaska.
A vessel sinking is a sequence of events, and the earlier you can make communication with the Coast Guard or someone that can help you, the better off you are. And so in an event like a skiff capsizing, if there's no way you can let someone know that you're in trouble, a PFD will keep you afloat, but you still, the clock starts ticking as soon as you hit that cold water.
You can survive immersed in the water for about 30 minutes until your core body temperature starts to drop, but you lose the ability to swim after 10 minutes. Although Jonathan Pavlik was not wearing a life jacket, Lincoln says he did the next best thing.
You can imagine the skiff was his personal flotation device. He was able to get himself out of the water as much as possible.
Jerry Dugan says the two Yakutat victims, Gray and Newland, also stayed with the boat for several hours, wet and cold. But hypothermia does not just pose a risk to our bodies. Prolonged cold can affect our judgment. A day of training can't change that.
Just when you need to make good judgments about what to do in your situation, the cold starts unpeeling the onion, that's your brain, and you don't make good decisions sometimes.
But training attempts to put some core information deeper in the onion, Dugan says, to give you something to hang on to when the right decision might seem counterintuitive.
An example would be you see the beach, and the beach is a few hundred yards away. Well, a knee-jerk reaction would be to go for the beach. A more thoughtful reaction is, do I have something to float on? What's the chances of being rescued and how long?
Pavlik was spotted by a passing pilot from one of many aircraft that flew overhead that day, most of which did not see him. It was a lucky break, to be sure, but he was around to benefit by it. Jennifer Lincoln says small boat fishermen, whether commercial or recreational, have to have a waterproof radio or some other means to hedge their bets, along with personal flotation.
The overriding fact is that Alaska has cold water, that PFDs do save lives, but there's a communication element there that is necessary for a successful rescue.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly.
There it is. Look, guys.
Wow.
Look, you see it? Look how big it is. Up close.
A snowy owl finds its home in the wild. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A judge today ruled the federal government was correct in listing the polar bear as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2008 because of global warming. The state of Alaska was suing to remove protections for the bear. At the same time, the Center for Biological Diversity was suing to increase the bear's status to endangered. Cassie Siegel with the center calls the ruling mixed. She wishes the judge had ruled in favor of the endangered listing, but was glad he wasn't swayed by the state's argument.
It is a very strong affirmation of the science, which had been challenged by the state of Alaska and others, and that the science more than supported, as of May 2008, the decision to list the polar bears threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
Siegel says since the polar bear was listed as threatened in 2008, the animal's plight has gotten much worse. She says the center may appeal the ruling. The state argued the threatened listing was speculative because it relied on forecasts of habitat loss due to climate change. Dan Sullivan was attorney general when the state first filed the lawsuit. Now he is commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, but he offered a quick response to the ruling today.
Well, in some ways, I guess that's obviously a disappointment, but I need to see the opinion, talk to the Attorney General.
The Department of Law says it's reviewing the 116-page decision and considering whether to appeal. Bethel Representative Bob Herron says that his region was hit particularly hard by Governor Sean Parnell's veto plan. According to Herron's office, the governor vetoed more money from his House district than in 39 of the 40 House districts in the state. Now he's wondering what motivated the governor's cuts. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
A glance at the capital budget and a few figures stand out. For those in the Kuskokwim area, it's the $34.5 million that Governor Parnell vetoed from House District 38. Following the release of his capital budget, Governor Parnell rejected criticism that his cuts were heavy-handed in the Kuskokwim region. He told reporters that region received more money per capita than any other district in the state.
I don't buy that.
Bob Herron, who represents the lower Kuskokwim.
That's an easy soundbite to say until you go to a community where they only were able to get one project funded and that was vetoed.
Herron admits that if you look just at the dollar amounts, the governor's per capita claim may be true. But he says that's like comparing apples to oranges.
Let's kind of analyze that.
The biggest ticket items that the governor kept for the Kuskokwim were two school construction projects in the villages of Quinnahawk and Nabuskiak. Expensive, but the state is required by law to fund rural schools following several federal court decisions over the decades. In most House districts around the state, local property taxes go towards schools, and so state spending there is minimal. The two schools were budgeted at $28 million and $33 million apiece.
So you add that all up, and is it really the highest per capita when it comes to capital projects minus schools.
Going further, Heron notes another big ticket item, improvements at the Bethel Airport, which moves the second highest amount of cargo in the state. The capital budget left in $25 million for improvements.
Well, it was introduced by the governor, and the governor's not going to veto his own projects.
While keeping all of his own projects, Parnell vetoed 45% of the Bethel area projects sponsored by the legislature. Bob Heron is not the only legislator from Western Alaska's biggest city. Senator and Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman is also from Bethel. House Minority Leader Beth Kurtula told the Anchorage Daily News that it looked to her like Parnell targeted Hoffman as well as Senator Burt Stedman for their opposition to his oil tax reforms, a charge the governor denies. Heron, though, is not so sure.
The governor had a criteria, and I hope it was only based on the criteria. But for my colleagues and others to say privately that they feel that it was vindictive, I hope that's not the case, but it sure raises the question.
Heron says he's pleased to see the governor did support a prenatal home in Bethel, which will house women with at-risk pregnancies that are safer near the city's regional hospital. The governor also left a host of wind power feasibility studies in the budget. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Census figures from 2010 put Alaska's population at more than 710,000 people. Newly released data indicates growth in all types of households, with the number of gay and lesbian households showing a sharp increase. The number of unmarried partner and husband and wife households also increased. I spoke with Ingrid Zaruba with the Department of Labor and Workforce Research and Analysis section about changes in the composition of Alaska households.
The trend for the population, the increases that we've seen across the state from the 2010 census, this data may just be reflective of that population increase. We're still evaluating the data and seeing where the numbers actually lie and the areas that they lie in. So I'm not sure that you can exactly extract a trend in the different composition of households. I would expect that just the social dynamics between them the last decade probably have made changes.
Can we attribute some of the increases in certain types of households simply with an increase in population?
Well, there has been an increase in certain areas of the state. The Anchorage area, Matsu area, Fairbanks area certainly had increases. Southeast had a decrease in population. I would say for areas where there was an increase in population, you could certainly end up with a variety of household makeups and family makeups.
Is there anything that jumps out at you right now that would suggest anything to be concerned about?
Well, we don't have anything concrete yet. We're still evaluating the data to see where the numbers actually fall in the different areas of the state. I think that there could be a concern, you know, for finding housing until we actually look at the numbers and can actually take an evaluation. I'm not sure that we can address that yet.
The number of unmarried people heading households has grown hugely by 44%. Does that tell you anything?
I'm not sure that it tells us anything other than you know, exactly what it says. You know, when people filled out their census form, they were asked, you know, if they what their marital status was, and perhaps, you know, that is just how the changes have occurred in the last decade, is that there's more unmarried partners, male and female, that are living together.
Where does this information go? Obviously, it goes to federal researchers, but what does it mean for the state of Alaska?
From the state's perspective and the people that work in the state, there are a number of various programs that will use this data because it has household data as well as housing data that can be used for programs that deal with children, public assistance programs. Local governments will use the housing data to determine what housing characteristics are in their areas. And this could certainly affect any funding or any type of economic development that the state or any local government would want to do.
Ingrid Zaruba is with the State Department of Labor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
National Park Service climbing rangers on Denali are in the midst of performing their first real search of the 2011 climbing season. An Austrian climber is missing from high up on Denali, and an intense aerial and ground search is underway. KTNA's Sudio has more on the effort.
Austrian climber Jürgen Kanzian, age 41, was last seen at 8 o'clock Monday night while heading up Denali Pass at 18,000 feet on the highly used West Buttress route. When Kanzian did not return to his tent at the 17-2 high camp by 8 p.m. the next night, a guided team alerted climbing rangers that he had not returned. Brandon Latham is the incident commander for the search and explains the effort that is different than what would normally occur in the lowlands.
Up higher, above 17,000 feet, it's hard to bring someone in, say from Talkeetna, and land them at 17. Just can't do that. So we use the camera as a search tool.
Rangers at the Talkeetna Ranger Station are glued to computer screens examining and zooming in on the hundreds of high-resolution images taken by aerial searchers. Kanzian has never climbed Denali, but has been on Elbrus and Aconcagua. He is a mountaineering guide in the Alps. He informed others that he plans skiing down the West Buttress route from the summit. Latham says that's not all that odd.
It's not abnormal to see people up there on skis, but it's not the norm.
He added that skis might have actually worked well several days ago after almost 3 feet of snow fell at high camp. Latham says they do find it interesting that Kanzian decided to summit at night.
He was going up at 8 p.m., and that's strange.
The aerial and ground search will continue on Friday as long as the weather continues to hold. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
A snowy owl named Lumi was released back into the wild earlier this week in Barrow. She was found in Yakutat last November and rehabilitated at the Alaskan Raptor Center in Sitka. We have two stories tonight on Lumi's long journey home. The first is from KCAW's Emily Bender, who saw her as she was preparing to leave Sitka.
Step one will be catching Lumi. It's Jen Cedarleaf and Victoria Vosberg's job to take care of Lumi and the other birds here at the Raptor Center in Sitka.
Catch her by tiring her out, basically, because she flies really well, so it would be hard to catch her.
So we're going to go back and see her?
We're going to go get her.
She swoops from her perch in the corner. Her wings make powerful downward strokes. She flies back and forth across the long cage. And she's getting a little too close to my microphone. Next, they strap her feet with Velcro and swaddle her in a neoprene suit.
We like to call it the scuba suit.
Last but not least, they give her a manicure. That's the nail file. Not to make her prettier, but more dangerous to her prey.
When birds are in captivity, their talons and beaks tend to overgrow because they're not, you know, doing what they would normally do in the wild.
We want to make sure a bird has every possible advantage when it goes into the wild, so we make sure that its hunting weapons are ready to go, sharp and deadly.
Now Lumi is all gussied up and given a clean bill of health.
Everything looks excellent. No concerns at all. She's ready to go. She gets whole mice with a little bit of vitamin, and we're just going to put this in her kennel so that she's got something to munch on while she's on the road.
The sides are covered with cardboard, so it's nice and dark in the crate for Lumi's long trip to the northern slope.
We want to keep her as calm as we can, and being in the dark pretty much shuts down their senses a lot, so she should be very comfortable, hopefully.
Adult owls eat about 5 lemmings, or little mouse-like rodents, each day. Snowy owls pair up and usually mate for life. Females like Lumi make their nests on the treeless tundra. When food is scarce, they won't lay eggs and sometimes end up leaving their Arctic climate to migrate south.
Last year they didn't even nest because the lemming population was so low, so there wasn't any food, so there were no chicks last year.
Don has had a tight grip on Lumi for about a half hour now. He carries her over to the crate.
Feathers inside, tail feathers?
Nope, tail feathers stay outside.
And then just let her walk in and just stay.
Give her a little bit of a push.
Bye, Lumi. Perfect.
Very, very nice.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Bender.
And this is Jake Neer reporting from Barrow, where the release of Lumi was a media event with reporters from all over the state in attendance. There was even a PBS crew filming. On top of all that were local spectators, dozens of kids, and a busload of tourists. Not long after 4 p.m. on Monday, Lumi the Snowy Owl made her big appearance in front of the crowd.
There it is. Look, 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 guys.
Wow.
Look, 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 look. You see it? Look how big it is. Up close.
Jennifer Cedarleaf with the Alaska Raptor Center in Sitka says Lumi was taken in after being found injured late last year near Yakutat.
Lumi is a female snowy owl that was sent to us from Yakutat in southeast Alaska the beginning of November last year. And she had been found under some power lines, and one of her talons looked like it was blown off of her left foot. And so we watched her for about a month, and her toe was not getting any better.
Cedarleaf says the Raptor Center staff decided they needed to amputate the end of that toe. She says the owl was most likely electrocuted by the power line she was found near, which caused the major injury to that toe. But besides that, Lumi was fairly healthy and made a quick recovery after the amputation. But Cedarleaf says it wasn't until now, about 7 months after the accident, that a release back into the wild was fitting.
She couldn't be released because we needed to bring her up here to where she would be in the summertime, and it's just really hard to release a bird in the winter when we don't know if there's going to be enough food and we want to make sure that she's going to make it. So we kept her at the Raptor Center in Sitka since November and have been feeding her lots of mice, and she's healthy and was finally time to bring her up to Barrow, and so we released her just today.
She says despite the missing talon, the owl should be able to adapt her hunting skills quite easily. Earlier this month, another snowy owl was released just outside Barrow. That owl was found weak and starving in Anchorage, also in November of last year. It was rehabilitated and released by the folks at the Bird Treatment and Learning Center in Anchorage, also known as Bird TLC. Officials with the Raptor Center say it's not all that common to be able to release a snowy owl in Barrow. They say they get about one snowy owl every year, and most are too emaciated to even treat. It's even rarer to be able to come up to the North Slope for a release. So for Barrow residents to be able to see two owls released in less than 3 weeks is pretty special. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Follow us online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey and Emily Bender in Sitka, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, and Jake Neer in Barrow. Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.